You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sam.
And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling all down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. Bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me.
Welcome to another edition of Raising San Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that was Johnny Cash live at San Quentin in 1974 doing Folsom Prison Blues, and it's introducing today's show, the third in our series on the U.S. justice and prison systems. In this era of homeland security and ever-burgeoning liberties taken with civil rights, few public policies have undermined fundamental civil rights and liberties, social justice, and public health for so long and to such an extent as the drug wars. According to the Drug Policy Alliance, the United States now has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with one adult American out of every 100 behind bars. The United States makes up less than 5% of the world's population, but holds close to 25% of the world's incarcerated. More than 500,000 people are behind bars for nothing more than a nonviolent drug law violation. More than 700,000 Americans were arrested last year for simple marijuana possession alone. The drug war even targets sick and dying Americans, thousands of whom are regularly denied access to medical marijuana, a medication with proven medical benefits for the treatment of a wide range of serious illnesses and conditions. We'll talk by phone today with Tony Papa about these drug laws and how he came to advocate for a review and change in the laws. Tony Papa is an artist, author of 15 Years to Life, How I Painted My Way to Freedom, and a communications specialist for the Drug Policy Alliance. He came to these things through being sentenced for 15 years for a minor drug offense after being set up. I asked Tony Papa to describe how this happened.
Well, in 1984, I made the biggest mistake of my life. I got involved with drug activity. I was bowling in a league in Yonkers, New York. And my car kept breaking down. And came late to the league a few times. And this guy asked me, why you keep coming late? And I told him about the car. Why don't you fix it? And I didn't have the money. So then about a week, two lady approached me. She says, look, I think I got a way for you to make some fast money. And he introduced me to somebody who was actually dealing drugs in bowling alleys in Westchester County. I knew the guy, heard about him. At first I said no, I didn't want anything to do with it. And then a couple of weeks later, it was near Christmas time, I got desperate for money. And when you get desperate, you do stupid things. So when the guy approached me again, he said I could make a fast $500 to bring an envelope from the Bronx up to Westchester County and maybe be a steady thing. So, like the carrot dangling on the string, I decided against my better judgment and went for it. And, you know, at the time, it was weren't too good at my marriage, and wound up bringing the envelope and walked into a police sting operation. Brought an envelope containing 4.5 ounces of cocaine, and walked into a police sting where 20 undercover officers came out of nowhere, and I was placed under arrest. I did everything I could do wrong. I didn't know anything about drug dealing and the criminal justice system.
And what year was this?
This was in about 1985.
Okay.
I actually got arrested in January 17, 1985, and did everything I could do wrong, and I wound up being sentenced to 2 15-year to life terms.
Two.
Mm. One for sales, one for possession under the Rockefeller drug laws, which were at the time, the most draconian laws in the nation, and they still are. First-time offenders who chose to go to trial, regardless of their involvement, was sentenced to 15 years to life minimum sentence. Mm-hmm. They could go all the way, 25, 30 years. I know some people have been sentenced to that.
Wow.
And for first-time offenses. So since I was a first-time offender, the judge gave me a break and ran the two sentences together, so I did a 15-year life sentence. Wound up going to Sing Sing Prison, which is a maximum security prison in Ossining, New York. Became prisoner number 85A2837. It was the darkest moments of my life.
This was the first time you ever had anything to do with the prison system at all.
Right.
You had no idea.
Arrested and anything. And I had got bad advice from a shyster lawyer who he was a shark and was interested in just getting a fee for going to trial. I actually talk about this in my book, 15 to Life, How I Painted My Way to Freedom. It was published by Feral House, my memoir. And it talked about the criminal justice system and how, people, not all lawyers are bad apples like this guy, but he was, and took advantage of the situation, and it gave me bad advice, and I wound up in Sing Sing Prison doing a 15 to life sentence. I was lost at first, didn't really know where to turn. In 1985, I was in the maximum security prison on the banks of the Hudson River, 2,300 prisoners. It was the wildest place you ever saw, unbelievably violent. Prisoners controlled the prison. The correction officers actually were selling drugs, drug dealers. They busted a big gang. Female correctional officers' prostitution ring in 1988. It was headlines of many major papers in New York. So it was a really wild place. It was really crazy. And what saved me from this nightmare was my discovery of art. I discovered who I was. Prison is a very existential environment, and what I mean by that, there's something mystical about spending, a 15-year sentence in a 6x9 cage. You find out who you are. So for me, I had this artist inside and came out, was brought to life.
And you had never done any artwork prior to that?
No. And I got turned on to art by another prisoner named Indio. His name was Indio, and he was fantastic painter. One day I was walking by his cell and I smelled the smell of oil paint and followed the trail, looked in, and I saw all these magnificent paintings.
Wow.
A guy painted like Rembrandt, and he saw me, turned around and got out, and it was very confrontational because you learn really quick that prisons has its own rules and regulations, all real life. So one of the rules is not looking in someone's cell. That's like a form of disrespect, which is high on the agenda in prison. Mm-hmm. And it can get you in real trouble. And he wanted to fight with me because I looked in his cell, and then I told him, look, I just was admiring your art, and I think you're a great painter. And then he had like a big, big head. And he, so sort of like, oh, okay. And then he says, do you ever paint before? I said, no. He says, you want to try it? So he gave me some watercolor brushes. Yeah. And went in my cell, stood up all night, got caught up in this beautiful energy in a positive way. And I started studying art and read various books and life stories about artists and painted every day. And it was really wonderful. And I started to have a job at the hobby shop where he worked, and I painted full time. And then I painted and was allowed to participate in some shows that they had in the local communities. And then I met this woman who actually changed the way I saw art. And I became friends with her. She saw my art, wrote me, and wrote back, and sent her a painting of a beautiful beach scene, you know, frilly white dresses and stuff. I was into French Impressionism. And then she told me, these are great paintings, but, you know, the art could be used for something else. So she sent me a book about the Mexican muralist, Diego Rivera or Orozco, and how about the art, how about they use their art for the oppressed against the oppressor. Mm. And then I started looking at art as sort of like a political tool on how I can make statements, you know, even from my little 6x9 cell up the Hudson River. And I, you know, read about Picasso's Guernica and just political art, and I got really turned on. I started making these statements and talking about it. And then in 1988, I picked up one night, after 3 years of this 15-to-life sentence, which my wife actually divorced me, and just my friends just disappeared, and I was like lost. I picked up a mirror, looked in a mirror, and I seen an individual that was going to spend the most productive years of his life in a 6x9 cage. I picked up this canvas, and I painted the self-portrait titled 15 to Life. Wound up 7 years later at the Whitney Museum of American Art while I was in prison. Mm-hmm. And this show, installation called Pay for Your Pleasure, which was part of a retrospective of Mike Kelly's art, an artist, a conceptual artist out in L.A. And from that point, I got a lot of publicity, sort of became a cause celeb, I guess, about the issue. I chose to talk about the issue through my art. And I started getting interviews by major papers, New York Times, all kinds of magazines. And eventually, about 2 years later, Governor George Pataki granted me clemency, executive clemency, where I literally painted my way out of prison.
Wow, and that's 15 years to life as the portrait that you're talking about on the cover.
My website also is 15tolife.com or 15yearstolife.com. And, you know, you can see, actually go on there and see my art that I did in prison, my new work, and just talks about now who I've become. I'm an activist now. When I came out, I really didn't know what I wanted to do in my life. I started speaking at schools. While I was in prison, I was lucky enough to get 3 college degrees while programs were available like that. Mm. Before they took away financial aid for prisoners. So I got 3 degrees. I actually got a master's degree from New York Theological Seminary. I studied liberation theology, which kind of went hand in hand with my political art. You know, I made all these paintings, all these political statements about the death penalty, just abortion, just the drug war. And when I got out, I started going to Albany, New York, which is the capital, you know, the legislature, and began advocating for changing the very laws that put me away, the Rockefeller drug laws. In 1973, when these laws were enacted, it became the toughest laws on the books against the drug war. Governor Rockefeller had presidential aspirations, and he wanted to be the toughest governor out there in the United States with the drug law, so he created these harsh laws.
Which was?
2-ounce sale, 4-ounce possession at the time. You get mandatory minimum sentence and 15 of the life, and judges did not have any discretion. Even in my case, the judge did not want to give me the sentence, but he was forced to because of mandatory minimum sentencing laws, which actually went into effect across the nation, and virtually every state under federal laws had that at that time when I came out, I, you know, decided when I was going to Albany, talking to politicians, I saw they had a dual view of what these drug laws were about. The public view was these laws work, we need them, but behind the closed door look was, look, I know they don't work, but if I advocate for these laws, I'll lose my job. Uh-huh. I look soft on crime. Uh-huh. So then I said to myself, well, I think I'm spinning my wheels going to Albany and trying to change the laws from the top down. So I remember reading a book in seminary by Donald Crabill called The Upside Down Kingdom, and talked about Jesus Christ changing the world from the bottom up. So I took that kind of that concept and I said, we need a street movement. So I was contacted by this political comedian, Randy Credico, who worked for the William Constance Fund for Racial Justice, the director, which he still is. I still work with them. And we put our heads together and we came up with this idea of starting a group called the Mothers of New York Disappeared. And it was big time. Madres Plaza de Mayo in Argentina in the 70s and 80s. The military took over the government. Whoever was subversive were murdered. 30,000 people disappeared. People were thrown from airplanes live. There were women were put in prison. When they had their babies, they were murdered, and the babies were given to soldiers. So it was a very suppressive environment at that point. And then the only people who really stood up against them were the mothers, the women of the loved ones who were disappeared. And eventually they went to the Plaza de Mayo, which was military, like a square in Argentina, and they had these candlelight vigils where they had signs of loved ones holding candles and nonviolent protests, and it got world attention. And then eventually, it took them many years, but they were brought to justice, the generals that committed these atrocities. So we kind of got that idea, and in 1998, May 25th, which was the 25th anniversary of the Rockefeller drug laws, we stood at 50th Street Rockefeller Center, which was symbolic Rockefeller drug laws, in New York City, and we held our first protest where about 25 of us, family members of those incarcerated ex-prisoners, advocates, held this vigil, and all of New York press showed up. So at that point, I said to Randy, this is how we're going to change these laws, by putting a human face right on the story. Right. At that time, there was really nothing happening in like that. And this movement that we created, we generated tremendous press. Stories were unbelievable, like this one 10-year-old girl whose mother was in prison. We used her to help us. She became an advocate. She was like the Shirley Temple of the drug war movement, speaking out against the drug laws, you know, going to Albany, speaking to politicians, and eventually generating this tremendous amount of press. What we did was we changed the opinions of New Yorkers, which in turn were the constituents of politicians who at first did not want to get involved because they were afraid of political death of their careers. And then because the people wanted them to be involved, they got involved. So almost everybody got on board, and eventually in 2004, the laws did change in New York, although they were watered down reform. It was a first step towards more reform, which we're still fighting to get significant reform, meaningful reform, which would help many people. Out of that reform, two changes were made in 2004, 2005. Like I said, the original intent of the legislature was to capture the drug kingpin and curb the drug epidemic. Well, it didn't work. The population, five times the amount, from 12,574 when it was 73 was enacted, it jumped about 72,000 top in the 90s. Now it's down significantly. There's about 18,000, 19,000. It fluctuates. Drug war prisoners in New York. With these two changes, basically, in theory, 1,000 people were only affected. And out of those 1,000 people who were affected, with who could apply for retroactive relief under the laws. Maybe about 1,000 people affected. Maybe 400 I got out.
Wow.
The rest could not because of procedural roadblocks created by district attorneys, which is the case today. And this is why we're still fighting for significant reforms. So it was just a start. Right now, what I do, I work for Drug Policy Alliance, which is the leading organization in the United States. And we're a group that's working to reduce the harms of both drug misuse and drug prohibition. I have a website, drugpolicy.org. You can find more about it. And I'm a communication specialist there. And what I do is I basically write op-eds and letters across the country on a regular basis. I post. I'm a blogger for Huffington Post, and I write for different several magazines to get the word out there that people do make mistakes in their lives, and prison is not the answer when it comes to drug use. I think society, especially the federal government, is hell-bent on the zero-tolerance drug policy involved in drug use, where they try everything. Even students are on the front lines of the drug war. Random, suspicionless drug tests. You have young kids peeing in cups, monitored by school, enacted by the federal government's program. They give rewards, actually financial aid to schools that start these programs. Even if you, people say, you might be listening and say, drug use is dangerous. It is. But I think the laws that are made that put people in prison for many, many years, like myself, for nonviolent drug offenses, I did more time than a violent murderer,
right.
If you look at it, the stats. So I think, for myself, as an example, I needed a wake-up call not to be thrown in the cage for 15 years.
Well, let me take a moment and remind our listeners that we're talking to Tony Papa about his experience with the Rockefeller drug laws, in which he landed up in jail for 12 or 15 years for a first-time offense. Tony, you were actually in so many ways lucky in that system because you found something that you loved. There are people like you went in for the first time who really didn't find that, and what are they looking at? What are those people looking at?
Well, prison is a horrible place, and I feel the way prisons and institutions run, if rehabilitation was high on the agenda, then every step of the level of imprisonment would be therapeutic and valuable, which is not. So right now, in my view, prisons are warehouses for people. It breeds crime. They educate prisoners that become better criminals without positive restorative programs. And what I mean by restorative programs is the ones like I had opportunity to be involved in when I was in prison, education. I had an art program, which actually in New York State they took away.
Now, all of pretty much the federal law against there's a federal law about education in prison. All of that has been taken away pretty much at this point.
Yeah, financial aid has been taken away state and federal levels.
Right.
So the programs are not available. There's just a couple of pilot programs. I know New York has two, the Bedford Hills for women and in Sing Sing. They're privately paid by donations by concerned citizens.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's insane for a country like the United States.
Also, it's insane because if you look at the stats, studies have been shown that recidivism is greatly reduced by more people who get an education, yet they take away these programs. It's all part of the get tough, John Wayne mentality.
But it also shows a lack of understanding about what it is, what a human being is, doesn't it?
I think they understand, but they don't care because this is, a get-tough policy with drugs across the board. Students now, you smoke a joint, get busted with a drug violation, you lose financial aid. You could lose federal housing if you if a crime is involved, you could lose your house, forfeiture laws, they can confiscate your property. It's craziness. It comes to a point where people might listen and say, yeah, but we have to try to curb the drug epidemic. I think it's all bogus. I think there's a way to do it, but being strictly punitive is not the way to treat drug addiction. I recently wrote a piece published in Detroit News and talk about Josh Hamilton, this baseball player who was on a spiral downward addiction, and he turned his life around, and he went to rehab 8 times, and he got a shot, came back, and now he's like a champion baseball player. And people could change their life, because with him, treatment was available for him. Most people can't afford treatment. I think community-based programs are the way to go, community-based drug treatment programs. Like in California, our organization initiated what they call Prop 36, which basically saved the state of California millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars and tens of thousands of life through treatment rather than incarceration for drug offenses. When I was in prison, I saw prison full of people who had drug problems, addictions, but they were there strictly under the punitive approach where they were sentenced to many years under Rockefeller drug laws. These laws, like I said, in the 80s were picked up by the federal government, became mandatory minimum sentencing across the board. In the federal government, you have disparities now with cocaine, powder cocaine and crack cocaine, 100-to-1 ratio difference in, getting sentenced to far more time for crack cocaine. These are racist laws. They exist on the board. So there's so many problems with this system. So I continue to try to speak out, try to, enlighten people on what's going on.
There's a lawsuit pending against Cook County where the prisoners have accused the wardens of excessive force and abuse.
Right.
So this is something that's going on, too.
Yeah.
In the prison. So you're sending young people or people there with one offense, like yourself, who have no way of understanding how the system works.
Right. And they get caught up in the system also.
Right.
Like I said, if it was truly made for rehabilitation, every step of the way would be therapeutic and value, where it's not. So it raises the question, the age-old question, what should prisons be about? Punishment versus rehabilitation. Alexis de Tocqueville raised that question in the early 1800s. This is a European aristocrat that came to the United States to study the American penitentiary. One of his first stops was Sing Sing, where he gave up on it. He saw the system was not really working. He went on to write that famous piece that politicians use today, Democracy in America. Anyway, so, this question, age-old question, has not been answered. How do you balance imprisonment with rehabilitation? I think it's something we have to answer, but we have not answered it now as a society.
Yeah.
And I think the drug laws are a perfect example why the system, we have 2.5 million Americans locked up, over 500,000 Americans because related in some way in drug crimes. In New York State, New York City, where I live, Harry Levine, a sociologist, in New York, put out a report, made 400,000 marijuana arrests within the last 10 years.
Hmm.
People getting arrested for nonviolent crimes, it's really crazy how the drug war, people become stigmatized. Even people listening saying, we need to control this problem, but it reaches out to those who are not even involved with drugs. Have you been to a drugstore lately where you went to buy a cold medicine, a Sudafed containing a chemical was now banned? It's actually you have to show proper ID and sign a log that's maintained by law enforcement with pharmacies and buying cough medicine. Because it has a Sudafedrin in it, Sudafedrin, one of the chemicals made to make methamphetamine. So, and you know, there's about 30 other chemicals you could do. Matches, flares involved too. So what do you do now? Mm. Make rules and laws that prevent you from buying those products. So it kind of got out of the way where, you know, people, everyday people now are affected. You go to a drugstore, you have to show your photo ID, log in a book to buy cough medicine. So sometimes it gets out of hand. Totally out of hand.
Well, let me ask you this. In your opinion, is there a difference in marijuana and, say, cocaine?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a tremendous difference. We advocate for medical marijuana, which has been scientifically proven to help people in regards to pain, to treatment. And yet 12 states have initiated medical marijuana laws. We just had an initiative in New Mexico that passed. We're working on New Jersey. But even though those 12 states recognize medical marijuana, federal government does not and continues to even raid hospices that people are dying you know, from cancer that will treat marijuana, raiding the hospitals, arresting people. It's craziness. So the federal government has zero tolerance in regards to any type of drug use. In regards to cocaine or heroin, those are hard drugs. I don't advocate for its use. I don't think it's, in our lifetime anything is going to be done to try to legalize those drugs. But I think we got a shot with medical marijuana, hopefully.
So in the jail, prisoners are getting heroin, for example. Is it fairly easy to get while you were there?
And I write in my book about it that where you, if you didn't have a habit, drug habit, going into Sing Sing, you would leave with a drug habit. So much drugs available, it was unbelievable. They had a place called Times Square in this maximum security prison behind the flats of the gym where you could buy any kind of drug you wanted if you had the money for it. Heroin was the drug of choice. They had guards smuggling in drugs. It was totally crazy. So, yes.
And so if someone gets hooked on one of those drugs, then there's no system to get them off it.
Well, they have drug treatment programs.
They do, okay.
In prison, but...
But there's nothing else to do, it sounds like.
Yeah, so, you know, you want to escape reality, you know, so you do drugs. And also, my point when I talk about this is that if you can't control drugs in a maximum security prison like the one I was in at Sing Sing, how could you control drugs in a free society?
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's a question I always talk about and ask people, where we need different changes in these laws. Drug addiction should not be treated as a criminal problem. It should be treated as a medical problem. And hopefully one day in society, I hope we initiate these changes across the board where people like myself who served a 12-year sentence, you know, waste their way in prison, cost taxpayers much money, alternatives to incarceration.
Let's talk a little bit about your artwork. One of the pieces that just really has stayed with me are the cavity search series that you've done.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. One day I was in the visiting room in Sing Sing. So what you have to do when you leave a visit, you go through a room where they search you for contraband. Because that's another way how drugs are brought into prison, by drug mules, people who, you know, put drugs in their anal cavities for men in prison. So this guard took me in a room. He stripped down naked, and you have to go through this procedure, open your mouth, behind your ears, fluff your hair, bend over, and then they look to see if they see contraband. So this one guard was, I guess, a new guard, and he asked me to bend over three times, which was very dehumanizing to me. And I asked him what he was looking for. And we got into sort of a confrontation, and the sergeant came, and he let me go. He didn't lock me up, but I wanted to write this guy up. I worked in the law library where it was a law clerk, jailhouse lawyer, they call him, for many years, and I was very good with my pen. So I went to write up a report, and then I found 20 pages of directives on how to search people's body cavities, radiological searches, mouth searches, vaginal searches, all kinds of. I was like stunned when I saw it. So I decided to paint about it. And I went and I did these automatic drawings with bullseyes and hand searching and stuff. And I took the directives and cut them into these like biomorphic forms and made out of like the signs pointing to the cavities. And I made 6 paintings. And then a friend of mine told this art dealer in Austin, New York about it and want to see him. So they came to get the pieces. And what I did was wrap them. I didn't have any materials, so I put garbage bags in them, but made the mistake of using a clear bag where they guards in the package room to send out the pieces saw them, and they saw this one piece that actually was a snitch note that was distributed by the warden of the prison asking other prisoners to tell on other prisoners. I never saw that before. It was just like unbelievable. So I blew his name up, and you know, they saw this piece, and they confiscated it, and then they said I couldn't send them out because I was trying to smuggle out directives. But these directives were public information. So it was, you know, you could get them, you could ask for them if you wanted, but they confiscated, I was locked up, and then I was called in the office.
So they confiscated the paintings?
They confiscated paintings, and they told me either they'd be destroyed if I didn't take off the directives. So I was forced to sit in the corner and, like, rip off the directives that were pasted on. And it was a tedious process, and 2 guards stood there, arms folded, making notes and taking every piece of paper that I got off there. I was like, and I hung my head low and went back. I said, wow, first they control my life for many years, and now they want to control my art. So what I did is I went back to the library, made copies, and then made diagrams where they belong on the artwork, and actually sent them in the mail and smuggled it out, actually, in the mail. And then I wanted to file a lawsuit, called my lawyer, and he said, well, you're crazy. You know, I had this clemency application pending for a year. My freedom was at stake. He said, hand it administratively. Don't bring this to court or you'll never get out. You never have a chance to win clemency. And I did that. And what happened was one day when in December, we waited for a clemency answer months later, I got called by the Depot Security. The only time you get called for that is if you have a problem. So I thought they discovered the smuggled directives in the mail, and I blew every opportunity for my freedom now.
Yeah.
So as I waited for the Depot Security, he called, came in, looked at me, and said, I just got off the phone with the governor. You're free. He granted you executive clemency. I broke down and cried like a baby. Couldn't stop crying because I thought it was about him. Those 12 years in prison just all came out. I'm sobbing. When I got the clemency, I got out maybe a month later. Actually, I was so happy when the first time they told me about it, I was telling everybody, and then people were looking at me like really angry looking.
Yeah.
I better keep my mouth shut because people would get jealous when people go home. I wound up getting out in one of the first shows I had in Manhattan at this place, the Outsider Gallery, showed my work, was this series, contraband series, where I put it together and I showed the world what I wanted to do in the first place at a gallery in New York City. And actually, you could see that. If you go to my website, you could see the actual paintings and the process and the directives online, 15thlife.com.
Yeah, really a good series. There's a lot of symmetry about it, really good pieces.
Yeah, the work I did in prison was, I never could do it again, but it really, if you want to take a tour through imprisonment, you could look at this art and really feel, you know, the art and the atmosphere, the environment of imprisonment, how the despair of spending, you know, the most productive years of your life in a cage. You know, I learned my lesson well in regards to what these laws were, the drug laws, and this is why I'm an advocate for life, trying to prevent others to go to prison for drug crimes. One of the first experiences I had when I came out changed my life forever, because when you do an extraordinary amount of time, most people want to forget about it and just go on with their lives. Well, what I did is I was invited to speak at this place called Spofford Correctional Facility. And when I walked in the auditorium, the auditorium was full of 10 to 15-year-old boys and girls dressed in prison garb. And most of them had substance abuse problems, and they were facing a lot of time in prison for drugs. And I couldn't believe it, and they asked me some really tough questions about imprisonment, because when they became legal age, they would have to go to prison. Mm-hmm. And some were sentenced for many, many years. And I said at that point, that changed my life around to be an activist, to be advocate for, you know, better prison conditions and change the way we treat people, especially people who have drug addictions, mm-hmm. Not a criminal problem, a medical problem.
At some level, I can hear somebody thinking to themselves now, well, you know, this guy proved that the system works the way it's supposed to. He went in and he came out and he's determined never to go back in again.
Well, you could say that, but sometimes the solution's worse than the problem. In a society where we spend billions of dollars incarcerating people, like I said, 2.5 million, the highest in the world incarceration rates. Most people, a lot of people in there for drug crimes. Drug crimes, drug addictions, treated strictly punitively is not the way to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, those 12 years that I lost in my life, I'll never get them back. And, you know, I was lucky enough at the time, took advantage of the rehabilitative programs they had in prison. They're gone now. Prisons are just horrible, horrible warehouses where people get lost and become worse than they do if they came out now. If you give somebody a 15, 20 to life sentence, they come out worse than they went in, because there's not... those rehabilitative programs don't exist anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point to push. I mean, you are one of thousands of people that went in and came out with actually a way to go forward.
Well, you know why? I think because I found meaning in my life. I transcended the experience through my art. And this is what you need, is these restorative programs that give people meaning and fulfillment in their lives, and that's how they can transcend. If you put somebody in prison for many, many years and you don't give those individuals positive restorative programs where they can, you know, be maintained but yet hold on to self-esteem, then you have a problem, because these are the same individuals that eventually have to return to society. And people need to understand that point.
Tony, are you still painting?
I still paint. I'm coming up. I'm going to show work in a show, Chaim Reed Gallery, September 3rd in New York City. We're having a big fundraiser for Drug Policy Alliance, a leading organization in the United States that fights the drug war. We're having an art show with tremendous artists, all top artists are going to be in the show. People could go online, drugpolicy.org, to find more about it. I'm going to show some work there, and I continue to show my work. I just did an art installation in John Jay Criminal College a couple of months back, where I showed this installation called The Drug War, based on 7 op-eds that I wrote and then made them into visual experience. Let's say one was called Give Them All Dirty Needles and Let Them Die, about needle exchange program in New Jersey. Our director, Roseanne Scotty, who actually wrote the op-ed for that, but I took that. It was a quote from Judge Judy in 1999 when she said that, and I made it into a visual experience. I got this coffin draped with the New Jersey flag, because New Jersey was the only state in the United States, the only place where it didn't have a needle exchange program. And despite rates of AIDS across the board, top across the board, and then finally, because of Roseanne, 13 years fighting for it, they got a needle exchange pilot program passed in 5 cities in New Jersey, where the laws changed. So, sort of, and then I had this installation, and educate people about the drug war. That's what I like to do with the art, is get people involved who might not necessarily be involved with the drug war through art, and make that connection.
And do you give any monies towards programs in jails to, you mentioned that most of the education that's going on there is happening through individuals now.
I work with a couple of groups that work with prisoners in jail that have art programs. You can go to my website, look under prison art, and you can get links to those Art Behind Bars, one of them, out of Florida, really good program.
Yeah.
Prisons Foundation in Washington, D.C., another good program. So definitely I work with them.
Yeah, I think it's really important to reiterate that that's what's going on. It's like individuals now are donating money to these programs,
right,
and not the system, not the people.
Right.
We pay taxes, and yet our money is going to the war. exactly.
Well, this is a war. It's a war on drugs, which is a war on people. I think people should realize that, and it exists for many years, and it's horrible. So we continue to fight. Like I said, you could go my website, 15alive.com, see the art, read about the drug war. You can go to drugpolicy.org, sign up for a newsletter, be informed about changes happening across the country, different programs, every state. And there's library. We have the biggest library, online drug library. People want to look at it online. Drugpolicy.org.
And are you seeing a positive movement forward, or are we just getting more authoritarian?
It's a long road to hoe, but the thing is, we got to keep pushing for positive change. I think, we continue, the struggle to fight for change. But there's definitely a movement, and what we do at Drug Policy Alliance especially is, we work to reduce the harms of drug use, drug misuse, and drug prohibition. So hopefully one day prohibition will be gone. It didn't work with alcohol. It's not working now. It creates a black market, and we hope to do away with that. Recently, like the New York Times, they wrote an editorial that really talked about, the failures in the fight against drugs. And while it was accurate, it missed the, overarching point that prohibition failed in the past and it wasn't working now. And that the tax dollars, the scarce tax dollars that are currently being wasted by the White House, they could be having decades of tax revenues that we're not collecting because of prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And these funds that they're missing out on could help pay for, honest drug education, free drug treatment on demand, and better health care,
mm-hmm,
all things we need. So instead of the flawed governmental hype that the government's putting out, we need policy alternatives to the drug war that uphold the sovereignty of individuals over their minds and bodies and are grounded in science, compassion, health, and human rights.
There you go. Tony, I want to thank you for being with us. That's Tony Papa. You can find out more at www.15years. That's number 15, yearstolife.com.
Mm-hmm.
The mothers of the New York disappeared.
Yeah, you could find information on my website about them.
Okay.
And you could go to drugpolicy.org to find more about the drug war and the work I do for them.
And also, if people want to donate any time, effort, or money particularly, they can go to any of those websites and get hold of you.
I appreciate that.
Thanks
for having me on.
Yeah, it's been great.
That was Tony Papa, artist, author of 15 Years to Life, How I Painted My Way to Freedom, an activist and a communications specialist for the Drug Policy Alliance. You can view Tony's paintings at www.15yearstolife.com. That's the number 15yearstolife.com. And learn more about the Drug Alliance at www.drugpolicy.org. You heard Tony state that while in prison, he managed to get 3 academic degrees, one of which was a degree in theology. You also heard him say that these federal education programs no longer exist in any federal prison. That is, if they do exist at all, they exist because of the actions of private individuals, donations, and nonprofit organizations, and they receive no federal funds. In a few weeks, we'll hear more about such a project at San Quentin Prison in San Rafael, California, when we talk to Jody Lewin of the University Prison Project, what it is, what are its goals, and what is its actual impact. I hope you join us for that show. Meanwhile, feel what it must be like as a human being to be locked up in a small cell, every moment vigilant for your life, and essentially with nothing to do for most of the day. Listen to the other shows we've done in this series on prisons by visiting our website, www.raisingsandradio.org, and use the sitemap page for a list of downloadable shows. Then, if you want to get more involved, you might consider donating time or other resources to the University Prison Project, and you can learn how to do that at prisonuniversityproject.org or via the Prison Literature Project that sends books to prisoners via www.prisonactivist.org/PLP or call 510-893-4648. Or to contact the Prison Literature Project, you can write to Prison Literature Project, care of Bound Together Books, 1369 Haight Street, San Francisco, 94117. Again, we've done shows on the Prison Literature Project, and I really urge you to go and listen to that. And you can find it on our website on the www.raisingsandradio.org/sitemap.php page. So thanks for listening to our show today on Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. As always, you're invited to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org and suggest shows you'd like to hear in the future. That's susan@raisingsandradio.org. We're going to go out with Johnny Cash doing the same Folsom Prison Blues, this time from the 1994 live concert at the Manhattan Center. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. How are you? I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around the bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antonio.
All views expressed on Raising Sand are that of the hosts and guests, not of KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Raising Sand on KZSU Stanford.
When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. Smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. If that railroad train was mine, bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line.